Blog Talk Radio.
Today's sponsor of Southern Sense is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audible entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Southern Sense.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
From a weary weekend, and welcome to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, and today I have a fascinating, an alluring, a most wonderful individual as my sole co-host, Cal Fritzy of Red Fox Radio. Good afternoon, Cal.
Hi, Annie. How are you doing today?
All right, all right. It's going to be one of those days, I'm telling you. I just have one of those feelings. Unfortunately, our other co-host, Dan, is not with us. I just got a text a few minutes ago that he is at the hospital. She just said that his wife told me that he was leaving the ER. I don't know if that meant he was going home or if they were admitting him to a room. So we are just keeping our eyes and ears posted. I've got the cell phone next to me in case she does send me another text to let me know what's going on with Dan. So he is in our thoughts and our prayers. And, Kel, we've got someone sitting that is always sitting here listening to us on BTR. And I want to say a good welcome to Sue. Good afternoon, Sue from New Mexico. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sue.
Hi, thank you.
Yes, Sue, and I did get your phone message, and I will call you later on about that item that I told you I'd like to give you. Okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Sue. I want to welcome everyone else that's coming into the chat room. And, gentlemen, I hope you have your little late notices with you. So, well, have a good time, that's for sure. We've got great guests coming in today, Cal. We've got three different authors. They all wrote about the same basic subject, you know, during World War II and the interaction between Allied and German aces, I should say pilots, because not all pilots are aces. And they all wrote about, one way or another, about our pilots, our American airmen, being held in concentration camps such as Buchenwald. something that very few people in history know. So it's going to be very interesting, to say the
all
least.
All three of them have fascinating stories. I was reading the bios on all three of these fine gentlemen, and believe me, they're going to have a lot to impart to the listeners. It's going to be a fascinating show, Annie. Kudos. Well done, girl.
Yeah, well, Colin Heaton and his wife, Anne Marie, happened to be friends of mine. I met them a number of years ago, and Colin has been a guest on our show quite a few times. And his wife, I believe, is working on a new book, so hopefully we'll have her on soon. And Adam Makos has been on our show also. So, you know, these are all people that I end up running into and talking to, and one person leads me to another, and we end up with these great guests. So, anyway, those that are listening in, unfortunately, our co-host Dan is not with us. I'm waiting to find out from his wife what is going on. Last she had texted me was that he was just leaving the emergency room. We don't know if that meant he's going into a room or if he's going home. What happened? We have no idea. So we're waiting with bated breath to find out what is going on with him. So in the interim, we'll keep him in our prayers. Now, Cal, you know, we start off each show with a dedication to a fallen hero. And this came across my eye, I believe, what was it? This was last Wednesday. And I ended up writing an article up on Pundit Press for it. And this now, today's dedication, is going to go out to a Border Patrol agent, Javier Vega, who was killed just this past Wednesday, August 6th. And I'm going to play Eternal Father since we don't have anything special for him. And this was from what I wrote on Pundit Press. It started off as a family outing in the Santa Monica area, Texas. A young husband and a former Marine on his day off of work with his wife. They took their three sons and his parents fishing for gar in their favorite spot. It was a fun day, and the evening was deepening. They noticed two men who passed their camping site a few times when they heard them shout out, telling the family to get on the ground. A discussion occurred, then gunfire erupted. Wallace County Sheriff Larry Spence said Border Patrol agent Javier Vega Jr., 36 of Kingsville, died of a gunshot wound to the chest, and Javier Vega Sr. of Lotharia was hospitalized with a shot to his hip. It appears that the suspects didn't think the father and son were armed. Wallasee County Sheriff Larry Spence told The Blaze, "We're still putting the pieces together, but it doesn't appear now that they knew he was a Border Patrol agent," Spence said. The Border Patrol agent apparently kept telling his dad to keep firing, Dad, keep shooting, Dad, at the suspects after he was already hit. At some point, the agent's mother apparently picked up the AR-15 rifle and continued shooting at the suspect's vehicle, hitting the windshield and other parts of the vehicle as the suspects fled. Marie Vega, the agent's mother, called authorities to report the shooting of her son and husband at about 8 p.m. on Sunday, Spence said. The suspect's vehicle was found abandoned with gunshot damage. Spence said the police believe the suspects tossed their weapons as they fled in their vehicle after the shooting. Gustavo Gustavo Tajirina, 30, and Ishmael Hernandez, 40, were interviewed multiple times and confessed to the shootings as well as involvement in several other incidents. They admitted they knew they killed someone, but were shocked to learn it was a Border Patrol agent. According to The Blaze, the sheriff said the two suspects were likely connected to cartels or other criminal gangs. They claim to be involved in other incidents. This means you've gotten stolen vehicles going into Mexico, he said. Everything is going to be cartel-related. There's a connection somehow. This is not the first episode of border violence in Wallasee County, but it's the first time someone's been killed, he said. Tijerina, according to records, had been arrested four times between 2007 and 2010 for being in the USA illegally. Although the first incident of illegal border crossing is a civil matter, a second offense, according to immigration law under Section 1325, is a felony punishable by 2 years of imprisonment. Yet, Chajarina freely crossed the border multiple times. Hernandez also crossed illegally several times and was also deported several times. He did not test positive for gunpowder and believed he was the getaway driver. It appears Teodorina was the shooter. Both Teodorina and Hernandez were arraigned on 7 charges: capital murder of a police officer, attempted murder, 4 counts each of aggravated robbery, and 1 count of tampering with evidence. Fox News reported, according to court records, Teodorina, who also goes by the name of Teodorina Sandoval, pleaded guilty to entering the U.S. illegally on July 9, 2007. He was given a 30-day sentence with credit for time served and charged a $10 fee. 3 months later, on October 4th, he was again found guilty of entering the country illegally and was sentenced to 60 days in jail and a $10 fee. In a criminal complaint, he said he entered the U.S. on September 1st and was encountered by Border Patrol agents near Wasco, Texas. On October 3rd, he had waded across the Rio Grande River near Progreso, Mexico, court records show. A year later, on October 25, 2008, he again crossed into the U.S. by wading across the river. On November 18, 2008, he was given 90 days in jail and another $10 special assessment fee. On December 15, 2009, Teodorina was indicted by a grand jury of charges entering the U.S. illegally again. The indictment said he had been previously denied admission, excluded, deported, and removed, knowing and unlawfully was present in the United States, having been found near Edinburgh, Texas. Court records say he had not obtained consent from the U.S. Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security to reapply for admission in the U.S. A warrant was issued for his arrest and said he faced up to 20 years in prison and a fine of $250,000. He was held without bail on January 26, 2010. He was given 9 months in jail and fined $100. Fox News sources confirmed that these court cases involved the same Teodorina in custody for killing Border Patrol agent Vega. They said Hernandez, the other suspect, had been deported twice for entering the U.S. illegally. Natalie Vega, the agent's sister-in-law, said Javier Vega Jr. is survived by 3 sons, ages 9, 13, and 18. The boys are taking it pretty hard, she said, Monday outside of the family home in La Feria. We are doing as well as we could be. She said the agent was shot at point-blank range. I don't think the agent got the gun out, she said. But her father-in-law returned fire as the suspects fled in a vehicle described as a maroon SUV. Natalie Vega said her father-in-law was expected to be released from Valley Baptist Medical Center in Harlingen. The National Border Patrol Council, the union that represented Vega, has set up a memorial fund on behalf of his widow and 3 young children. To find that Border Patrol fund link, please go to Pundit Press, scroll down to the article titled Border Patrol Agent Killed, and in the last paragraph, you will find the memorial fund. We dedicate this show to Border Patrol Agent, to all the brave men and women who protect our lands from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror. We dedicate this song to them. My name is America. God bless them all.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. For those who need me, I'll always be here. For those who will harm me, I'll face without
Herndon. My name is America, and of course you know he was our guest here on the show on Friday, and you know, just go toddallenherndon.com and you can download that song for free and pick up his brand new album. Kel, we got ourselves a great guest on the line already while we're waiting for his other two buddies to call in. Want to welcome aboard Gerald R. Barron, author, and I just had the book directly in my fat little hand and I'm losing my mind. I swear, it's going to be one of these days. And I here it is, and I put it back. The title of the book.
Well, when I saw the blue banner in the studio from a Blog Talk Radio and their service, I went, oh no.
Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Anyway, Gerald wrote a book, A Fighter Pilot in Buchenwald, The Joe Moser Journey. Fighter pilot near. Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
All right, you got to understand we're a little unorthodox here, since this is not broad terrestrial radio, so we have no format. We're all free form here, so you never know what's going to hit us. But I got your book because you had said you're going to mail it out to me, and the very next day it arrived, and I put it aside to start reading, and then over the last few days, I started going through it. And I'm telling you, this is a page-turner. I've read a lot of good books, and I'm an avid, avid reader. But I picked this up, and I just could not put it down. I mean, it went everywhere with me. And it's
a fascinating
story.
Yeah, it's a great story, and I was really pleased to be able to work with Joe Moser on that, and so that's a high compliment, and I really appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you, and this is a history that very, very few people know about. I first learned about it when I first met Colin Heaton, that might have been back in 2009 or so, and then that's when I started to find out about our American airmen. If they were captured by the Germans, a lot of them ended up inside concentration camps, like Buchenwald.
Well, only the 168 that were in Buchenwald in this particular group that we're aware of. There were other servicemen from various services who ended up in a concentration camp for one reason or another. And in the documentary that we did called Lost Airmen of Buchenwald, there's some references to Mauthausen and I think another concentration camp. So it wasn't common at all, and there were kind of special circumstances why these guys ended up there, but nevertheless, there were 168 who were taken from the prison called Friends in near Paris and put on a train and sent to Buchenwald and scheduled for execution there.
Yeah, out of the 168, 166 did make it back, were rescued by, actually by the Luftwaffe, and two did not, unfortunately. But
right.
Colin Heaton originally started writing about the treatment of various airmen, and he was originally wrote about it when I became aware of it in the Star of Africa, where Marseille had this one airman that he took under his wing that happened to have been from Africa, I believe South Africa? I forget which he was flying for. Bad memory. Anyway, he actually took him as his orderly in order to protect him, especially because he was black. And the Germans had absolutely no respect for the black soldier or airman.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, Colin tells another interesting story about the order from Goering to when the Tuskegee Airmen were flying, they were ordered to, any captured black airmen were to be turned over to the Gestapo, presumably for execution, because Hitler did not want the German public to hear any stories of African-American pilots shooting down German pilots. And that order, again, was not followed by the German fighter officers. And I think that's one great service that Colin Heaton has done to the world in bringing forward the chivalry and honor and integrity of so many of the German officers, of the German Luftwaffe officers in particular. So and certainly what happened in freeing the 166 airmen that were still in Buchenwald by a German officer was, you know, certainly an indication of this kind of honor.
Yeah, that is an absolute truth. Now, tell us a little bit about your background, because when I was looking up your information for the show, you were more involved in business communications and helping businesses get their message out. The last thing I expected was a book like this coming from you. What caused you to write this?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, my career has been in business. I've been an entrepreneur for about 35 years or so, primarily in the communication business and also in software development. I developed a system that's used pretty broadly and with major companies and government agencies called PEER, which is a crisis communication management system that's used for helping to manage public information during a crisis. It was the system that was used both by the federal government and by BP in the Gulf oil spill of 2010. So yeah, I developed that and worked with a lot of companies. So writing is more of an avocation than it is a vocation, although I certainly did a lot of writing in my career in terms of public relations and crisis communication, that sort of thing. But I've been interested in World War II history in particular for many years. My father grew up in Holland during the war between the ages of 10 and 15. So my grandparents were hiding people out who the Nazis were looking for, and he had many interesting experiences there. And I think plus being a pilot, I was extremely interested in World War II fighter pilots in particular, growing up, you know, from a very early age. And actually, Ghost wrote a autobiography of a German soldier who spent 4 years on the Russian front as a machine gunner in Hitler's army, and then returned home to Austria to win the silver downhill skiing medal in the 1948 Olympics. And he was somebody that lived here in our town in Bellingham, Washington. His name was Franz Gabel. So after I wrote that, I showed it to a friend of mine, a good friend, and who wasn't much of a reader, but he read that and really enjoyed that book. He said, I need to introduce you to my cousin, Joe Mosier. And he said he was a P-38 pilot in World War II and got shot down, and that's about all he told me. And I kept after him for about 2 years to say, hey, when are you going to introduce me to Joe? And he finally did, and that's where I met Joe and started learning about his absolutely amazing story.
Now, is this a lot of his words? Did you just, you know, put them in format, or, you know, are you putting words in? I'm not saying this.
Yeah,
right.
That's a great question. And, you know, probably maybe it was a mistake of mine to have to say it was authored by Joe Moser, because Joe is a terrific guy, and he actually did make an effort a number of years ago to write his story down. But Joe is one of the most quiet, humble, and inarticulate and people that you could imagine. So, no, he did not write it. I think I counted 36 interviews with him, in addition to he had a pretty good collection of his squadron history and some other books, and then the other resources that I used, such as the Buchenwald Report and other ones, to put the story together. But no, I wrote the story. It's put on there as told to Gerald Barron. But I wanted to write it from an autobiographical point of view, and so that's why I said it was by Joe Moser as told to me.
Now he's still alive, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yep, he's 92, almost 93 years old. He lives in a little town called Ferndale, Washington. He's remarkably healthy. He has these beautiful, bright eyes that just light up a room. And he's certainly showing some of the aging indications. He lost his wife about a year and a half ago, and that was very, very difficult for him. But he has, family around. He has 5 children, 4 daughters, and a son, and lots of grandkids, and so he's got a lot of family around him, and lots of friends, and he's become a bit of a celebrity in our community. It seems like just about everybody's read his story. And he was a furnace repairman for his work after the war, and all these people from the community just knew him as the furnace repairman, and when they read his story, they just said, "Why didn't you tell us, Joe, what you went through?" And he didn't tell anybody. In fact, his family didn't know anything about Buchenwald, the concentration camp. They knew he was a prisoner of war, but even his wife didn't know that until she read about it in the newspaper in 1982. He finally submitted to a reporter interview, and that's how his wife found out about his experiences. I was talking to them and kind of asking, I said, "Gene, how in the world did you not know about this?" And she kind of laughed and said, "Well, communication was never a strong point in our marriage."
It reminds me of a joke my minister told me, but it actually was a true story. He was doing a wedding ceremony on Saturday, and one of his sons turns around to the bridegroom and says, "Listen, a quiet man is a thoughtful man. This is the only advice I'm going to give you. A quiet man is a thoughtful man. A quiet woman is a pissed off woman." So that goes to say a lot about communication in a marriage.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, how did you get involved with Colin and Adam Makos?
When we did when I did the book, and then when we worked with Mike Dorsey on the movie, The Lost Airman of Buchenwald, with the one big question that was out there was, how in the world did these guys get out of Buchenwald? And Mike did an awful lot of research on that and found some information about how they might have gotten word out through the camp. But we did not know. In fact, I met a German Air Force officer at one of the fighter group reunions. He came over from Germany. He's a current colonel in the Air Force, and I talked to him about that, and he said he was really trying to find that out. And he tried to put me in touch with a general who headed the German Air Force at that time to see if we could do research. So we were trying to find this out, and I picked up Adam Makos' book, The Higher Call. And I'd heard of the story of Franz Stigler before. In fact, Franz Stigler lived right near us here in northwest Washington. He lived in the British Columbia area. We're right on the border here. But he had died shortly before Joe and I came to his flying club to speak. But so I knew of the story, but then I read Adam Makos' book, A Higher Call, and I'm just reading along, and I come to this part in there where Hannes Trautloff is talking about finding these guys, these Allied airmen in Buchenwald, and what he did to get them out. And I just about fell off my chair. I said, here's the answer. So I knew Marcus Brotherton, who had worked on, or I think was a co-writer on that book with Adam. And so I contacted him, and he said, well, here's Adam's email. So I sent an email to Adam and told him my question, and he directed me to Colin. Colin was terrific in getting back, and we had some phone conversations and sort of told me the whole story. So that's how it's on there. It's totally by accident, but it was a great piece of information that resulted in Trautlach and his family being honored at the Buchenwald Memorial dedication of the plaque this past April. So, and Thomas Anschutz, the German Air Force colonel that I talked about earlier, was there and gave recognition to Hannes Trautlach and for what he did to get these men out.
Yeah, now what very few people really understood was that the relationship between the Allied fighters and the Germans, you know, they respected each other. You know, when they bailed out, it was not usual for them to, the pilots to be strafed. You would get a couple of lone wolves, but they were not respected within the Luftwaffe. You know,
right.
So
yeah.
One comment that I think Colin wrote in his book about Steinhoff, where when something like that happened, they said, well, why don't you go to the Waffen SS, you know, if you're going to behave that way, you don't belong in this unit.
Right. Yeah, I was struck, and again, you know, learned so much in reading Colin's books about the, you know, the conversations with them aces. Just the level of honor that they had, but also their disdain for the Nazi party. Steinhoff and Rudel and some of those, they would not allow, according to Colin, members of the party to be part of their units. And if they were, you know, if they were in there, you know, they were much distrusted. And that was quite a bit different than what I found out, you know, in dealing with Franz Gabel, who was a machine gunner in the Army. Although most of the Army folks absolutely hated the Nazis, you know, the real sort of true believers that would come in, the officers that would come in, they hated them. So even within the Wehrmacht, the Army, there was a real difference between, you know, the regular Army and those that they considered to be, you know, Nazis or real party people. But, yeah, that was... I don't think it's something that most people understand to this day, and that was exactly what Trautlach was talking about in the conversation in which he talked about getting these men out, because he said the rumors that you're hearing about the concentration camps, the gas chambers, and so they're all true. He's telling his fellow officers, and he said, we're going to be you know, tarred with the same brush. We're going to be considered to be a part of that. And he was absolutely right, and it's true to this day, is that we see the Germans as the enemy at that time, basically as one mass, without realizing that there was a big gap between the Nazis and those like you know, Trautlach and Steinhoff and Rudel and those that were fighting for their country, all right, but not with you know, not as Nazis.
No, that's true, and it's really, really struck me, because having read Colin's books and having read Adam's book, The Higher Call, you know, a lot of these pilots actually knew each other over the years. You know,
mm-hmm.
they knew, if they didn't know you, they know of you, and it was very, very difficult to hide the fact that you disdained Goring and Goebel and Hitler, and I think Colin paints a really great picture in his book, where German Aces Speak 1 and 2. He really paints the picture very nicely. And having read them and then read your book, it just brought everything together. And that's why I was hoping the other two were going to be calling in, but I guess they fell asleep at the wheel.
Well, I know Colin was planning on it, because he texted me a little while ago reminding me that, I'm surprised that they haven't called in.
Oh, well, I guess maybe Anne-Marie hit him over the head with the baseball bat or something, so he's out cold.
Right.
Now, reading the story, you know, and you could tell Joe is a very, very humble man, a very quiet man throughout the whole thing. And you painted a wonderful, wonderful and loving picture of him. And he talks about, you know, being rescued here by the Luftwaffe. And he really didn't know who was behind all of it. So I ended up going back and reading Colin's book, you know, German Aces Speak Too. I did a quick speed reading through to the part where Steinhoff is talking about the whole incident. And what struck me was the contrast in the manner in which they were treated. Here they were treated, you know, not exactly as royalty, but when they got into the actual prisoner of war camp where the other fellow pilots were, they were upset and surprised about how the POWs were complaining about their lot in life, and yet they had just come from a hell, and they thought this was like the Hilton. This was the Marriott. This was, yeah, you know, five-star treatment.
Absolutely, and yeah, the contrast was very stark, especially in Stalag Group 3, where they were at, and by the time they got to Moosburg, right at the end of the war, the conditions in these camps had deteriorated to such a degree that it was more like in terms of latrine facility. I mean, just because of the overcrowding and the lack of food and the lack of organization. I mean, they had 140,000. POWs in Moosburg before it was liberated in a camp built for something like 10,000. So they had conditions more like that, but in the standard POW camp in terms of how they dealt with each other, the kind of conditions, the food, the whole structure was completely different. And yeah, you're right, the prisoners there, I thought they had it pretty tough until these guys came and started telling them how things really were. but at that point, they were sort of discouraged from talking about it too much, which is one of the interesting parts of the story.
That's one of the most fascinating parts. Now, after I just made fun of Colin, I do believe he is on the line with us. Good afternoon, Colin Heaton.
Hey, I've been listening to the whole show. I've been here the whole time.
And I got to just put my eyes up onto the studio a little bit more every now and then. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I'm glad Gerald got on because he had a good story to tell. So, not about me. I mean, my role's not important at all, but his book is great.
No,
his
book.
Well, I'll tell you, Colin, you're absolutely wrong about that because without the history that you did, the interviews with all of those guys, first of all, I'm so grateful to you for bringing their true character to light, but also immensely grateful on behalf of these wonderful survivors of this incident that you could put in place the final piece of the puzzle that was really the sort of great mystery that we were dealing with.
Well, it's ironic because all the meetings I had with Hannes and his wife Marga, he never mentioned the name of the camp. He only mentioned the incident one time, and it was very casual. Yeah, I found some prisoners, and I got them out of the camp. It was in bad conditions and put them in a better place. That's all he ever said. And it wasn't until Steinhoff and Gustav Rudel and some of the others began telling me, yeah, well, we had this meeting. Here's what Hannes told us. And I'm like, oh, really? So, and by the time I was able to get back to Hannes and ask him more details about it, he'd passed away, so...
Wow, that's amazing because, you know, I mean, obviously that's how history plays out because, you know, I know Joe and I know Joe's family and I know some of the other survivors of Buchenwald, and to think that without Hannes doing what he did, which in my mind took pretty considerable courage and honor on his part to do that, you know, these families wouldn't be here because they absolutely would have been executed and cremated. And for the most part, probably nobody would have ever known what happened to them. So,
that's true.
You know, honestly, it's a really big deal for them.
No, it's funny because Joe writes about an incident, and then throughout some of the other reading, I see the same thing being repeated, that the guards, when the airmen came into Buchenwald, would point at the chimney at the crematorium saying, there's only one way out, that way. And they basically were letting him know, you're here to die.
And every one of the survivors that we've talked to, and I'm counting about eight of them right now that are alive, said the same thing. As they marched past that crematory, as they entered in, they were told by the guards, that's how you're going to leave. That's the only way you're leaving here is smoke through that chimney. And Joe, you know, the smoke from the crematory was pervasive throughout the camp because it was just burning constantly and couldn't keep up with the load. And Joe could never stand the smell of burnt bacon. They would not have bacon in the house because he couldn't stand the smell. And he had nightmares. Joe was such a quiet guy. I didn't hear until after the book, I wrote the book from one of his daughters, that they would wake up in the night hearing him screaming. And those nightmares went on for 40-some years until he visited Buchenwald in the early 1990s, I think it was. And he saw that there was no more smoke coming from the chimney, and his nightmares stopped.
Wow, that is powerful. You know, you also write about the incident where he does crash, and he only had a very, very short career as a fighter pilot, and telling the tale of how the plane was going down, and he was waiting to get clear of the tail so he didn't get impaled by the tail. That was just so riveting, and I remember sitting here reading those pages going, jump! Jump, jump, and I'm screaming, my mind is screaming, jump. The way you described it was so amazing that you felt as if you were right there.
Well, that's great to hear. And it was, you may recall that is how the book began, right? It was basically the first story told of him bailing out. And that was a question I had in terms, and I'm not a professional writer. So, be fun to talk to Colin or Adam who, you know, do this for a living. But, it's one of the challenges that I had in writing it is so many of these biographical or autobiographical stories you start with, well, I was born and raised on a farm in Ferndale, Washington, and, I this is what happened to me. And then, you know, you're about two-thirds into it before the really exciting stuff happens. And so I decided I'm gonna start. This is such a great story of him bailing out. And, you know, barely surviving his toe getting caught on the canopy and him riding this plane until the wind pressure absolutely tears the toe off his shoe. That's such a great story. So I started with it, and then it was kind of back and forth, and I was never sure if that was going to work as a narrative device. So it's really, it's gratifying to hear your response.
Yeah, and there's so much that is in there that, you know, you can take hours to just go through the whole book. But one of the things that really, really bothered him was that there was two French farm boys that were trying to help him escape after his plane had just crashed. And they knew the Germans were on the way. They knew the Germans were going to be searching for him. And they helped hide him and then tried to help him completely escape from the Germans. And they ended up, all three of them, being caught. And it was 4 decades before he actually found out whether or not these two boys were killed or if they still lived. And it was something that also haunted his dreams those years until he made that trip overseas.
Yeah, I mean, Joe is, it's probably not the typical fighter pilot picture that you have of this, you know, brash, arrogant, you know, cocky. I mean, he probably had some of that in him when he was 22 at that time, but a very sensitive guy, and the things that really bothered him were if he thought his plane had crashed into a farm building and he thought maybe people in there had been killed, he found out later that it crashed right next to it, and so it hadn't been. There was burn marks on the stone wall of the building. But the other thing was these two men who were in the wine cellar with him, he thought they had been executed for trying to help him escape. And you probably recall this, and that's a great little vignette as well. What happened was it wasn't the two young farmers who were trying to help him run through the field, get to the woods when they were caught. It was what the Germans did is they took Francois Vermeulen, the owner of the farm where they were, and the mayor of the town of Marchefroy, and stuck them in the cellar with Joe. And they never talked, but Joe didn't know who they were. He thought maybe they were Germans there to watch over them that night. But when they opened up the door of the wine cellar, pulled the truck away that was blocking the door, and they opened it up, and then closed it again, he heard two shots. So he thought they had executed these two, and he thought they were the guys who had helped him escape, and they really got a good look at him. And he thought that for 40-some years until Art Parent, who was one of the guys in Buchenwald and who was the president of the KLB, the Buchenwald Concentration Club, the Club of the Survivors, had a letter that was written shortly after the war, 1949 it was, from Francois, who had hidden arsenic in his farm. And the letter explained about Joe being captured there and that and explained about what happened. It actually was a French soldier who was, or a Frenchman who was impressed into the German army, who was the guard. And but he was from eastern France. But when, so he took these two guys out and he told them to run and he shot two shots in the air to cover their escape, acting like he was shooting at them. So he basically helped the mayor and this prominent farmer escape. And he became so popular after the war for what he did here with Joe that he ended up living in the town, marrying a local girl and running the local gas station until he died about a year before I, had a chance to talk to him when I was working on Joe's book. So it's a great little story.
Now, is there a special website they can get the book, or can they just go to Amazon?
That is Amazon. It is available through through bookstores, but Amazon. And also, I should mention the movie. I don't know if you haven't had a chance to see that yet, right?
No, I only got that email late yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to actually get the movie because I saw on the site, if you order directly from the site, which is lostairman.com, they would mail you the DVD. And I didn't want to go. You can get it at Amazon, where you can rent it for
$2.99. Right, you can get the DVD on Amazon. And it's been on TV quite a bit, the Military Channel and some other channels, so people might have seen it that way as well. But that's the story of these 168 as told by, I think it was six of the survivors, including Colonel Phil Lamison, their head officer from New Zealand, who is absolutely one of the most amazing people you could ever meet. You talk about a leader. And these guys, Joe, here, all these, 70 years later, you start talking about Phil Lamison and his leadership, and his eyes fill with tears, and he said, "I'd follow that guy anywhere." He's just a remarkable leader. A sheep farmer from New Zealand who then finally started getting some recognition for what he did and his role in leading these men.
Well, I guess you can honestly say he was a shepherd of his people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But,
he was a tough guy, I'll tell you.
But what they did was he was actually a burr in the side of the Germans because he would actually have the guys form up in formation and march past them, which drove them crazy, didn't it?
Yeah, he did it for a couple of reasons. He wanted them to keep some unit cohesion. They were military men. He didn't want them, the whole process of the prisoners in Buchenwald was a process of dehumanization. And I think by keeping them as a military unit operating and acting like a military unit, it really helped to fight that. But they also were, all of them, many of the people when they were preparing for the day when they would be, they would have the opportunity to overcome. So they wanted some of that military as well. But also to remind the guards, these are soldiers. These are, and he reminded them every chance he could, you're violating the Geneva Convention. This is not where we belong. We belong in POW camp. And that irritated the heck out of them.
I'm glad they did, because it actually kept the morale going. And, here in Buchenwald, you had the civilians and he talked about the look on their face, the hollow, haunted look. And he felt that they had it, but maybe that's why they were able to survive so much better, because of this shepherd.
Well, and I think so. And the approach that they took, keeping them as military men. That's a really interesting question you raise. Did these guys have that? Well, Joe went from 167 pounds, I think, to 113 pounds. Chap Bowen was down to 98 pounds by the time he got out of Buchenwald. So they certainly were starving and pretty emaciated. But whether or not they lost the light in their eyes, like, I know it certainly at times that they did, because there were many times that they felt it was completely hopeless and that they would indeed go out through smoke through the chimney. But I think Lamis and his leadership made a world of difference. You know, he knew through his sources, primarily the British SOE officers, made famous by the White Rabbit movie and book, he was in contact with them, and he knew through them that they were scheduled to be executed around, I can't remember exactly, October 24, October 27, something like that. So he knew that, and he was getting more and more desperate as that day approached to say, what do we do, you know? But he never told the men. He kept that to himself until a reunion in Canada, in Toronto, I think it was, in the 1980s. Is when he first told the men at the reunion that they were all scheduled to be executed. And possibly the same way that 16 of those British agents died, which was by piano wire hanging from the knee hooks in the basement of the crematory. An absolutely horrible way to die.
Well, first Colin wrote about it, and I kind of like, when you wrote about them being called, what was it, terror pilots? Yeah, terror fleeters. And I remember reading it in Colin's book, so I actually, Colin, went back to your book, and I found it in the section under Steinhoff. And the logic was is that if the underground helped them when they crashed, that makes them terrorists and part of the underground. Am I getting that right?
Go ahead, Colin.
I was going to say, well, no, not necessarily. The reason they were called terror flyers was propaganda, so that the German civilians would have no compunction in violating the Geneva Convention and handing them over to the Gestapo. It was all propaganda, because the Geneva Convention of 1929, which was in effect, stipulated that once an airman bails out, he is a legitimate prisoner of war, and cannot, unless he conducts ground combat operations, he's a noncombatant.
Okay.
What I was going to add is that I talked to several of the survivors of that, and they had different answers. It's in the film as well. They see consistent answer to why they were called terror fleeters. But the movie, and I've seen their prison records, where it was absolutely struck out that they were, where it said U.S. Air Force, on Joe's card, those that were struck out, and it said police prisoners. And some of the cards says, when they were in Buchenwald, said, not to be moved, which meant that they were to be executed there. So, but they, in terms of why, and it would be called terror fleet, Joe thought it was, and I know he's mistaken in this, it was because they had been issued the order that anything that moves on a road after D-Day was to be a legitimate target. And so I think he felt that that was why they were being called terrorists, because it didn't matter if they were civilian or not. Well, the truth was there wasn't any civilian movements, because they knew of this, and they weren't, anything moving was German at that particular point. But the other guys had different theories. I think Colin is right, although every one of the 168 were captured and put in Friends Prison and sent to Buchenwald, were all captured as part of the underground, with the underground, and they were in civilian clothing, except Joe. Joe was captured, within an hour after his bailing out. So he wasn't, he had his uniform on yet. But so a lot of them thought, well, they weren't in civilian, they were in civilian clothes, they were with French underground, and that's why they were treated that way.
Now, it's funny because, Colin, I remember reading about this one particular traitor in the French underground, and you went over it a little bit also, Gerald, in your book, but obviously Joe was not too familiar with this individual and didn't know all the backgrounds, so which is why I'm glad, Colin, I went thumbing through your book again. They all traced back to this one traitor by the name of Jacques, I'm going to mispronounce, and I used to take French in school. De Sobry, and
yeah, right.
He was paid, they were being paid 10,000 francs per American pilot they turned over.
Right. Yes, very, very interesting side story. And there was a guy in France who we had contact with who had done a lot of research on this. And Jacques de Sobry. Again, Joe was the only one of the group, at least that I'm aware of, that was not turned over by Jacques because he was not part of the underground. You know, he was just starting to escape when he was captured. But everybody else had been betrayed. And this guy had infiltrated the network, and they thought he was taking them to Spain, and that the underground network did. And instead he drove them to Gestapo headquarters in downtown Paris. So the guys, again, it's well told in the movie. That the survivors had the same story. They got in this car. James Stewart, for one thing, very Scottish guy, can hardly understand what he's saying. He said, got in the back of this car. It was using gas. He said, thumped his head and said, oh, this looks like trouble. And all of a sudden they turn around. The people turn around. They're facing pistols. And they all said the same thing. For you, la guerre finis. For you, the war is over. and that's when they knew they were in trouble.
Yeah, that was really, really amazing that, you know, here, 10,000, what is that in U.S. dollars?
10,000 francs? Boy, I don't know at that time, but I know that he lived quite a lifestyle. It was a lot of money because, you know, he had his car, he had several girlfriends, he would buy these expensive suits and cigars, and he would kind of flaunt his money. But, I suspect he turned over many others besides his 167, but, he made a lot of money off the Germans by infiltrating that network.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, you also write about in the book a death march, because as the war was winding down, they were and the Russians and Americans were advancing, they wanted to use these pilots as hostages then.
What happened was it was in late January, after the Battle of the Bulge, the horrible winter that they were having. These guys were east of Berlin and what's now Poland, called Sagan. That's where Stalag Group 3 was at. And the Russians were approaching. They could hear the artillery fire from the battles. The Russians were. So the prisoners in there were about 10,000 Allied flyers, mostly officers. They had kind of separated the officers from the enlisted men. So this was basically an officer camp. And they did not know what the Germans were going to do. They were afraid that they would carpet bomb them and just, you know, kill them, everybody in the camp that way, or, they didn't know. Well, what the Germans did, they obviously didn't want to lose their prisoners, so they marched them in the horrible blizzard conditions starting about midnight or early, very early in the morning, and marched them for 66 miles, I think, to a rail station at Spremberg. And so many of the, quite a few of them did not survive. Joe would not have survived. Joe was still in weakened condition. He'd only gotten out of Buchenwald in late October. So this was, just a few months after. He was still, he said he was probably 120 pounds at that point. So he was still kind of regaining his weight and strength. He collapsed on the march, and he would had died of freezing to death if it were not for two of his roommates who picked him up and carried him the last quarter mile until they got into this town and got him into a hospital. It was something that really bothered him, that he didn't keep track of who these guys were, and he was really hoping with the book coming out that he would find out who these guys were and could thank them for saving his life.
So I understand, and hi, Gerald. I'm Cal Fritzy. I'm co-hosting with Annie today. I understand on the death marches, if you collapse, the Nazis would just shoot you automatically and leave you in the ditches, but he survived that despite his weakened condition?
Yeah, and I don't think he was laying there for very long before the guys picked him up. You're absolutely right. There were certain stories of that, but I also read stories in the, there's a book on Stalag Loop 3, you know, flyers were in there, and they were talking about that, and there were other ones who, it was this all-American football player, you know, big, strong, rugged guy going along, and he just, he finally laid down, he called the chaplain over, and he said, I'm going to die, and the chaplain stayed with him, and Billy died. So there were, you know, other stories like that. It wasn't, and actually a number of the German guards, many of them were older men at this point, they were on the same march, and a number of them died as well from exposure and you know, freezing to death. So it was tough on all of them.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, Joe, when he got back home, no one wanted, actually, when he got out of the prisoner of war camp and he was released mm-hmm. back to the U.S. side, no one really wanted to believe his story, nor did they want
right.
to believe anyone else. As a matter of fact, it was all kept top secret.
Yeah, and I learned more from talking with some of the others, and, you know, and while the film was being made, because, you know, that was one of the questions that a lot of them talked about. And it was a matter of great frustration and even anger, even bitterness to this day. The Australian government, for example, I think until the 1980s, denied that there were any of their flyers in Buchenwald. And it took many years in Canada, for example, for there to be any official recognition. And the guys, the survivors, had various theories about it. I know that Chap Bowen, one of the survivors who lives in California, said that he thought it was because the Americans were trying to lure some of the top German scientists to the U.S. and they didn't want to infuriate them or anything like that. I don't really know what the reasons were, but they all tell the same story, and that is they were told by authorities that it didn't happen, and they were told to keep their mouths shut. And for what reason, it still is not clear. Joe, when he was got his debriefing to be released from active duty, was debriefed by a lieutenant, and so he was asking him about his experience, and he said, and Joe said, well, you know, he got shot down, and he got sent to Buchenwald concentration camp, and the guy said, no, you didn't. There were no Americans in a concentration camp. And Joe said, well, look, I was there. And he said, no, you weren't. There was no Americans in there. And he said, well, if you say so, but I was there. That was one experience.
Can
and,
I interject?
Yeah,
go ahead, Colin. Jump in any time.
Well, I can answer that question.
Okay, wonderful.
The reason being was because when Truman became president following the war and the dropping of the atomic bombs, they knew there were three things they had to do. The most important thing was called Operation Paperclip, and that was where they began harvesting Wernher von Braun, Walter Dornberger. I mean, all the geniuses who had worked on German technology, well, the rocket program, the jet propulsion program, they wanted all these guys. Truman was against it. Truman didn't want to bring anybody over who had a Nazi Party membership, and all these guys were Nazi Party members because if you didn't have a member number, you didn't have a job. And so Dallin Dulles, the CIA director, said, well, okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's just smooth the road out, and let's just kind of suppress a lot of this bad propaganda, and that way it'll be more palatable for Congress to say, okay, yeah, we can see bringing these guys in to help us since the Soviet threat's rising, we've got a new Cold War, Churchill's jumping up and down. So what happened was these guys were probably part of that larger picture to suppress the slave labor factor. And it wasn't the executions in the concentration camps as much as it was the forced slave labor that Wernher von Braun and the others used to build their programs using captured Allied airmen, which was a violation of international law.
That, you know, that makes perfect sense, and it certainly corroborates what Chap Bowen's story was, is that that's, you know, they just didn't want the trouble that would be caused by that. So appreciate that, Colin.
No problem.
You keep answering more of my questions.
Well, I've got to take a 1 minute, 5 second break trying to earn some money here. So we'll be back in 1 minute, 5 seconds. Here we go. Southern Sense is now being sponsored by Audible Books. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of these online books, you know,
I don't like, you know, having to download them and sit in front of a computer or my smartphone or something and read. But I checked out Audible, and I was amazed. If you go to audibletrials.com/southernsense, you get a 30-day free trial. Now, I tried it out, and I wanted, because you get a free book if you download, and I decided, what book am I going to download? So I thought, what do I not have time to read that I can listen to and be enriched? And I downloaded the Federalist Papers. Now, this is a 3-volume, 9 hours of recording, 30-some-odd dollar value I got for free. So check out audibletrial.com/southernsense and download your own free book.
All right, and we're back. You know, this is really, really fascinating stuff. You know, I'm thinking back to one part you wrote in the book, Gerald. As they're going through this death march, they're going from camp and staying for a few days to another camp, to another village, and they're going through all these places, and they're passing these villages. And one of the villagers came over to them and said to Joe that the war is over, your president is dead. They didn't understand right. How our American system works.
No, absolutely. But in a way, you can understand that because sort of the way it was in Germany, you know, as Adolf Hitler went, so went Germany, which is why, you know, quite a few of the German officers tried to get rid of him. So I think, you know, the people in Germany saw much more of a connection between, you know, the leader and sort of the fate of the nation. They didn't really understand the American system, that there would be this relatively smooth transition. So, yeah, that was interesting to me, too, to see that perspective, especially since it was so close to the end of the war. This was, what was it, April 12, something like that, where, you know, Germany was right near the end, but they still felt that with that they were going to win the war.
Yeah. Now, you got to pardon me. I'm getting a little background noise here. It looks like we got a thunderstorm coming in, so just bear with me, guys, here. But, you know, Colin, when you read his book, what was your impression of Gerald and his writing?
Oh, Joe, as far as his character as an American, as an American fighting man, as a human being, I find him to be one of the more stellar characters, comparable to many of the men I interviewed from any nation who was a believer in his cause and stayed true to his faith and true to his comrades. I mean, he's the kind of guy who should have his picture hung up in a high school named after him, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, because I really love the writing style. You know, it was, like I said, once I picked up the book, I just couldn't stop turning the pages. And a few times I went back over to reread a section to make sure, you know, I've got the full flavor of everything. And Colin, you yourself do the same thing to me. So I'm honored to have two very talented writers. And I'm sorry Adam Makos isn't with us, because it would tie all three of your books together. Actually, I should say four, because Colin, you've got two. You also have The Star of Africa, where you start to enlighten me, where I started to learn about a lot of the things that were going on between the Germans and the American fighter pilots and how they treated each other and how they had such a disdain for the Nazi party and the Nazi hierarchy.
Yeah, they hated them, and they hated them for a reason. It wasn't so much because of the Jewish situation in the 1930s. That was disdainful and distasteful to many, but the problem was that if you were a Nazi party aficionado or a member, you got special perks, privileges, and often promoted above your peers who were probably better at their job and better soldiers, better officers. But if you had the connection, you got the promotion, and they saw that as being a slap in the face to the men who were really fighting for the country.
That they did. You know, what did you get out of this when you, Gerald, when you were writing your book? Were you finding that sort of a dichotomy also?
Yeah, but again, not until I started reading Colin's books did I really understand the depth of disdain between them. You know, we certainly were, the primary thing was, you know, the rescue of these guys from the Luftwaffe and the speculation that the survivors had about as to the reasons, but once I started reading Collins' books and understanding more of the character and nature of these German fighter pilots and officers, I really came to a much better understanding and what happened in Buchenwald to get these guys out became sort of more part of the pattern. I should mention one of the things that we talked about, and I was surprised to read in Collins' book, the restrictions or the against German pilots strafing Allied pilots, or Allied fighters in parachutes, because it was part of my understanding that that was a fairly common practice among the Germans and a somewhat rare practice among Americans. It's now my perception, right or wrong, it was much more common among Allied flyers to shoot enemy pilots or enemy airmen in parachute than it was the other way around. I did become aware of one incident that's well documented from Joe's fighter group, the 474th fighter group of the 9th Air Force. It was, I think, a pilot from the 430th, Jimmy Frederick, who was shot at by and nearly killed by a German pilot, a very well-known German ace, but who was also then immediately shot down by another P-38 pilot by the name of Bob Milliken. So there were instances of it, but I think it was relatively rare, and again, learning from Collins' book, that it was something that the German officers basically prohibited. And certainly the book Star of Africa, Hans Marseille demonstrated some amazing chivalry in situations where he had shot down enemy aircraft. So that was all very interesting and enlightening. Again, I appreciate Colin so much for bringing that part of the war history forward.
Oh, wow. This is all amazing stuff, absolutely amazing stuff. You know, as like I said, I've got all four of the books sitting here right here next to me, and I'm telling people, go over to Amazon.com and pick up this book, A Fighter Pilot in Buchenwald. Also, go to Colin's website, which is HeatonLewisBooks.com. He's got all of his books up there. Colin, what are you working on now? I know you've always got something in the work, always two or three things.
Right now I'm just gathering some interviews with some World War II Germans for a production program that I was hired to do, and we're trying to get these guys to agree to interviews. And then I plan on working on a couple of other books, but my agent has to tell me which one to do, depending upon which publisher wants which book. So, but right now I'm wanting to do my book on the American pilots speak, which has my interviews with some pretty famous American pilots who are household names in this country that I did.
And, Gerald, are you working on a new project, too?
Well, not a World War II history book. I'd love to do another one. It's, I keep sort of looking around for the right kind of story. No, I don't have any history book in mind. Working on a book on a totally different topic about science and the intersection with faith. So it's a completely different topic.
Wow. Wow, that's very interesting, because the church I belong to, they have several different books in their bookstore, I know, on that subject and how faith and science can coexist together and how a lot of scientists themselves are faithful. And here comes the storm. Oh, well.
Obviously, we're not supposed to be talking about this topic.
He hath spoken. Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing, though, that the TV commentator and journalist Rita Cosby wrote a book about her father, who survived the Warsaw Uprising, the second general uprising of 44, and I've been in touch with Rita for a few years, but one of the books that I want to do is a typical type of chivalry Trautloff demonstrated to the men at Buchenwald from an SS colonel who was the division commander of the 5th SS Panzer Division Viking, who was a very effective and ruthless soldier on the Eastern Front, but he did save the lives of hundreds of Polish soldiers who were captured with the civilians during the uprising, and he countermanded the order of Himmler and actually convinced his superior, Lieutenant General Eric von den Bock-Zalewski, not to send all these people to Auschwitz. Most did go to Auschwitz and Treblinka, and they did die. But the guys in uniform, Muhlenkamp actually put them on a train to a prison camp as an SS colonel. So I think that's a pretty good story I want to do.
Oh, that sounds great. Of course,
that's great.
You're going to send me a galley copy so we can get you back on for that one. Yeah, there's so many interesting stories, and I'm sorry that Adam wasn't here with us because his book...
He's in Barcelona, Spain right now.
Ah,
He's tracking down people for his next book.
Ha ha, okay. Well, we're going to have him back on as soon as he gets back here on the stateside, because his book, A Higher Call, you know, with all three of your books, ties the whole story together, and you begin to see how everything interweaves. And what I found fascinating is that, Gerald, with your, these fighter pilots that found themselves in Buchenwald, and as they were crossing paths going from camp to camp, they all came from generally the same area, if not, you know, close vicinity. Yeah, how could that happen? You know, that's kind of like a freaky statistic there.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question.
Well, here you've got Joe Moser out there on the West Coast, and then as he's running into these other pilots that are there in the camp with him, they all come from the same general geographical vicinity.
You mean where they were shot down or where they lived?
No, where they lived.
Oh, not really, because they, I forget how many different nations were involved, from New Zealand and Australia. I think part of it is because, you know, of the survivors that we became familiar with. But, you know, there's Ed Carter Edwards and James Stewart from Canada, Don Shearer from the Mid-Atlantic area, Dick Bedford is in England. Don Leslie is in Washington State, and Joe Moser from Washington State. But I think they were kind of scattered around. I think Jack Bowen from California. I'm not sure there was too much of a pattern there.
Yeah. Now, there was one specific incident you write about in the book where this one bomber had been badly, badly damaged, was limping home, and Joe somehow or other got disconnected from the group he was leading, and he found himself alone, and he came across this bomber, and that was fascinating story.
One of my favorite stories, and I just remember, you know, Joe telling me about it, and he was just, you know, he was so matter-of-fact about these things, and I just about fell off my chair when Joe told me. But let me just tell it briefly. I think it was a raid on May 13, 1944. It was a long bomber escort mission. The P-38s were to pick up the bomber, the B-17s coming back from a long mission over Berlin. And they were at a rendezvous with them over Denmark, over the Baltic Sea. When they got to the rendezvous point, at 25,000 feet, the anti-aircraft fire was intense, so the squadron kind of broke up. And by the time they got Joe got clear of that, he tried to regain his squadron on the radio, and he couldn't find anybody. He couldn't see anybody. They were all scattered around. So he was by himself. So he said, well, might as well head back home, which was a long flight from over Denmark back to the southern England. So as he did, he came across this lone B-17 with two engines out, and those were the stragglers that the Luftwaffe was looking for at that particular time. And they weren't really able to even keep their altitude, so they were slowly going down. So, and they were going, you know, as slow as they could. So Joe was in the fighter and going faster and needed to keep up his fighting speed, started doing big S-curves behind him. So he would stay behind him and doing all these big S-turns. And so he followed him all the way back. They got to the English Channel. They were almost in the water at that point. He watched them dump all their guns out, all their radios, all their clothing, everything they could to lighten the planes to get over the channel. They did. They got just to north of England, and they peeled off heading to their base, and Joe headed back to his base in southern England because he was almost out of fuel. Well, end of story, until the 1990s, Joe was at a church picnic at his Catholic church in Ferndale, Washington, and he saw this big Native American who grew up in the reservation about 2 miles from Joe's house that he vaguely knew. His name was Earl. And he had overheard Earl talking about his World War II experience. He said he was a Turk gunner in B-17. He was on this long bomber mission to Berlin, and they got shot up real bad, lost two engines, and would have been shot down except this lone P-38 came up behind him and started doing these big S-curves, and then he told the story about them dumping all their stuff out and everything like that, and finally Joe couldn't stand it anymore, and he says, Earl, I think I was that pilot. Many years later, and the neighbors, and so it was an amazing story.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, because everything seemed to always come back to somewhere around his hometown, how he would run into all these guys, you know, later on, and how they started to have their now their annual meetings. Now, they started a club, a KLB club, which were the airmen
right.
at Book of Bowl.
Yeah,
well,
what was
the KLB?
Concentration Lager. Concentration Lager, which means Lager is camp in German. Concentration Lager Buchenwald. So basically the Buchenwald Concentration Concentration Camp Club, KLB.
All right. How many more of these guys are just left alive? Because we've been losing World War II vets, you know, they're dropping like
flies.
Yeah,
we're trying to kind of keep track of them. I mentioned a number of them. And we just found one the other day in upstate New York, a Lieutenant Warren Thompson. A neighbor of his contacted me because he came across the book or the movie, I'm not sure. And so Warren Thompson just sent me a letter and with his phone number, and I got to give him a call. But he's a very active 90-something farmer in upstate New York. And there's Joe. Dick Bedford is from England. There was just a story there in the paper about him. Ed Carter Edwards, an absolute character from the Toronto area in Canada. Don Shearer, I mentioned, is in the Mid-Atlantic area. Chad Bowen is lives in Orange County, California. James Stewart, a very Scottish gentleman from in Canada, the northeast part, and then Don Leslie, who's from Squim, Washington. So those are the ones that we are aware of. And if your radio program, if any of you listening to it know of any others, we would love to know about them, and we kind of try to keep these guys together. They don't have reunions anymore, but between Mike Dorsey, the filmmaker of our family, and myself, we try to keep them connected and a little bit together.
Yeah, it's very fascinating stories each and every one of them have. And here, you know, we grow up, they're our fathers, our grandfathers, but we never bothered to ask them the stories. And one of the things my husband regrets is that not asking his father to talk more about what happened to him during World War II. Because I know, Colin, I told you this, he was in the artillery. He was a major in the field artillery for the Latvian army that was fighting the Germans as well as the Russians. And my mother-in-law ended up losing most of her family because her brothers refused to work for either side. And they were executed, and she hid in the fields. As a matter of fact, Colin, you wrote about in the German Aces Speak some of the things that were happening in Latvia and how the women, what didn't matter how old or how young they were, how they were brutally attacked, raped, and murdered, not only just in Latvia, but Russians anywhere they came across women. They were told by Stalin, you know, go ahead and do this. This is what I want you to do. And how she was able to escape with his sister in her arms. And eventually they ended up in a displaced person's camp in Germany, of all places, after the war. And these stories aren't told. These stories aren't told. You know, these are things that do have to get out. And unfortunately, my mother-in-law is now gone. And I didn't get a chance to meet my father-in-law before I married Yanni. But, you know, here are the hidden stories that history is not teaching us. This is not being taught in the classrooms. People aren't talking about it, and Buchenwald, to this date, still does not have the American flag as one of the flags of the nations of people that were interred there.
Well, think about it. It's not that unusual. First of all, I mean, I have to give the German people credit. I mean, it wasn't long after the war they came to terms with their immediate past, and they made amends, and they made great amends. I mean, the Germans, unlike the Japanese, to this they don't even acknowledge that there was a rape of Nanking, okay? The Germans actually took ownership, and they said, never again, you know, and we'll make sure that we're a better people, we're a better country. But the Eastern European countries, after so many years of communist influence, and even the people who were the survivors of the camps, even those people were told not to talk about that experience. So I think it's maybe a collective amnesia or maybe even a social psychosis that it's easier to try and forget than it is to try and remember.
That's the shameful part of it. And for some reason, people that did survive the Holocaust in these camps, they felt some sort of a shame, which was hard to understand, but they survived where they saw everyone else didn't. And it brought up, you know, very painful things. A friend of mine, Naomi Litvin, wrote a book about her mother being in one of those concentration camps. And it's very, very touching, but you can feel as she writes through her book, you know, the highs and lows her mother felt about surviving, how she felt she didn't deserve it. And maybe that's one of the, another reasons why these stories have taken so long to come out. You know, Gerald, well, you talk. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I was with Simon Wiesenthal as his house guest a couple of times and in Vienna, and I asked him a question. I said, why is it that so few people really do discuss the Holocaust and what happened? Simon said something very interesting to me. He looked at me, handed me a brandy, and said, I'm going to tell you this and never forget it. We as a human species will do the most terrible things and then deny that we've done them simply to assuage our conscience.
Wow, that is the truth. That is the absolute truth. And, you know, to read these stories and how someone like Joe was able to survive and the guilt he felt in having been able to do that, too, is amazing. And here, this is an American fighting man. This is a man that we, as a nation, we're proud. But to be reduced to the level of survival he had, he is subhuman. You write about it very beautifully, Gerald, describing it and everything.
I want to make a comment about that because when I was working on Joe's book, I picked up a copy of the Buchenwald Report. The Buchenwald Report is the eyewitness testimony recorded by American intelligence officers right after they entered Buchenwald to record the, basically the getting witness testimony in preparation for the war crimes trial. And what those inmates at Buchenwald shared in terms of what they dealt with is just beyond belief. I got physically sick reading it. And I had to make some choices in writing Joe's book about what to include and what not to include. I'm kind of stunned when I read some of the reviews on Amazon about Joe's book talking about, you know, how hard it was to read some of the stuff in Buchenwald because they don't know the half of it. I chose not to put in there a lot of the absolutely horrible things. But I remember talking to my wife when after I read that, and I said, you know, these people who are doing that, they are not so different from us. That may sound like a terrible thing to say. I think to a certain degree, most of us have the capacity to be that evil. There was a process. They went through a process of dehumanization. And if you can dehumanize another person, there's no limit to the, it seems anyway, that there's no limit to the evil that you can, you know, bring on them. And, you know, and still live with yourself. It seems hard to believe that that's possible, but I think, you know, unfortunately it's in us. And that to me became such a powerful warning and message to say, as Americans we think we're, moral, strong moral people with integrity and honor, and we are. But it doesn't mean that in certain circumstances in the we're not capable of dehumanizing other people and participating in some of that same level of activity. Maybe not to that degree, but it's within us. At least that's one of the lessons that I took from it. Colin, I'd be interested to hear your response to that.
Well, I agree. I can't add.
Well, actually, Colin,
Annie.
That's all right. In your book, you write about that part with Steinhoff where he's witnessing these Russians as they're herding up everyone and murdering the fathers and the husbands while they attack the women, and how brutally this went on for days and days and days. And he alluded to even much worse happening. He would just say there's a lot more that was worse, but I don't talk about it.
Yeah, that was Hartman.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hartman.
Yeah, that was Hartman.
That part of the book really struck me as just sort of the same sort of thing that I was talking about, Colin.
Well, yeah, because Hartman and Hermann Graf, who I also interviewed, was there and who I witnessed this, and a couple of the others. Walter Wolfram was there for the first day or two, and then they let him go because he thought he was going to die anyway. But, yeah, it was horrible. I mean, what the Red Army did was never really discussed in the Western media because they were, after all, our allies. So it was a matter of choosing your devil. And with the Eastern Europeans, to this day, really don't forgive the Western powers. They don't forgive the Americans, the British, the Canadians, and Australia. They don't forgive the Western allies for abandoning them to the Iron Curtain because they really suffered with that. And there's a lot of animosity there until until it lifted in 92, and with Poland and some of the other countries becoming more involved in NATO and becoming absorbed into the Western sphere of capitalism, then it started to smooth out. But the people of Eastern Europe felt betrayed.
And that I can attest to, because if you were to speak very well of FDR in my mother-in-law's house, you were shown the door none too politely. And to this day, you say Yalta around my husband, and he'll explode. He will explode. And it's true, you know, FDR and Churchill gave away, and they had no idea what they were going to be subjecting these people to.
Well, Churchill knew. And Churchill was at Yalta with Stalin, and he was there with Roosevelt. And Churchill warned everyone. Anthony Eden, he warned everybody. He said, look, Roosevelt is the man in charge because America's putting more dollars, more materiel, more manpower into this war, so I take a back seat, but he's going to screw us over. And sure enough, Roosevelt was mentally feeble by that time, and he had this rosy liberal outlook that, oh, everything's going to be fine, Stalin's going to keep his word, free elections in Eastern Europe, and Churchill's like, you are an idiot. And Churchill knew his enemy, and he knew it wasn't just Hitler. And Roosevelt sold us down the river and sold the world down the river. And Truman knew it, and Truman tried to take charge of it after he became president, but it was really too late. So dropping those two atomic bombs was not just about ending the war in Japan quick. It was about sending a message to Moscow, like, look, we have this. Don't screw up.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're going to be back in 1 minute and 5 seconds. I got to try one more time to try to earn a couple of dollars and pay for the show. We'll be right back.
While we take a very short break, let me tell you about our sponsor, Audible. Audible are books that you can download online, and you can sit back and don't have to read. You can hear it play in the background. I checked out the free trial, and the free trial you can check out is at audibletrial.com/Southern Sense. And the book I chose to download by free trial was The Federalist Papers. And I can't wait, because when I sit in my office and I'm working, I like something playing in the background. Normally it's, you know, listening to some other talk show or listening to some music. But this way, I can be enriched and have something. I don't have time to sit down and read hour after hour. I got over 9 hours of recording of over $30 value of the Federalist Papers as a free sample. Just trying out audibletrial.com/Southern Sense. Check them out. You'll be pleased.
All right, we're back. And our phone lines are open. If anyone wants to call in and ask some questions from Colin Heaton or Gerald R. Barron, it's 917-889-3675. Now, Kel, I know, I'm sorry, I cut you off in the middle of asking a question. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Annie. And just to let you know, I lost the chat room. I love BPR.
Good old BPR. Anyway, go ahead.
I had a question, and Colin, I believe it was you that said that sometimes the veterans, it's easier to forget than to remember. And my father was a World War II veteran. He rarely spoke about the war. Do you suppose that if we had been more persistent in asking questions, they would have been more willing to talk? We always hear about the veteran that says, you know, I don't want to talk about it. But do you suppose that they actually really did want to talk about it? It's just that nobody was asking the questions? And
No, mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think, let me tell you, if you think American veterans were reluctant to talk about the war, you try cracking into a German veterans reunion.
Mm.
I was a member of many of the associations, including the Luftwaffe, and that's how I got a lot of the interviews and contacts. But no, I mean, men, and I've served with guys who don't even want to talk about their time in the Army or the Marine Corps because, you know, mm-hmm. it's easier just to move on. And I have my own experience a couple of times where my wife will look at me and go, hey, I just read something in this article that you're involved in. We want to talk about it? I'm like, no. And prefer not to, because to me it wasn't important, but to the historian it is. And as a historian, I can see that the reticence in these men discussing reliving the bad parts of their careers is more of a self-preservation catharsis method than it is of just the guy who's going to go out there and brag and talk about all this stuff. It's not the guy you're going to want to write about. It's the guy that you have to drag it out of, who at some point in time over his fifth beer says, okay, let me tell you something. Maybe it's time I tell somebody. And that's how you get the stories.
That is absolutely fascinating, and that
of course with Steinhoff, it only took three bottles of wine.
Yeah,
for me it'll be a better bottle of scotch. But you know, Colin,
you
really
for a lot of these guys who are reluctant to talk about it, and Joe being a great example, I think it became very important for them late in life, and I think you know, when they hit their 80s or you know maybe late 70s or things like that, I think that they start to have a realization that they were involved in some pretty important things, and it's of high interest to other people, and I think it really starts to mean something to some of them. But not all of them. I keep hearing some people say, oh, my dad just died, and he was in the Battle of Bulge, and, he would never really talk about it. It's really such a shame.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because I understand what you're talking about, Colin, you know, having been a New York City police officer. There's a lot of things I never talk about, and a lot of things you just shove into the back of your mind, and you completely forget. And then suddenly someone will say something to you, and all of a sudden everything will come back. It's like, oh, yeah, I completely forgot about that. And, you know, you just kind of dismiss it, and you just keep on moving on and moving forward instead of moving backwards. You know, if I had to, I probably would sit down with all my memo books and start going through the pages and going, oh, my God, I really did this. I was really there. You know, it's a really funny feeling.
It is. By the way, speaking of Gerald's book, I'd like to throw some piece of trivia in there you might find interesting. You remember the movie The Great Escape?
Yes. Oh, yes.
And that's about that camp. And that's about the Stalag Luft III camp at Sagan, the escape of 43. Donald Pleasence, the late British actor, played the blind guy, Colin, who got away with James Garner, remember?
Right.
Well, Donald Pleasence was actually in that camp as a POW during the war.
Yeah, I recall that, yes.
Yeah, and I had the privilege of speaking with him once about that. And he said, going back to that set and where they built it and reliving that event was the most amazing experience of his life. And until they were filming with Steve McQueen and those guys, he never discussed it.
Wow. Wow, that's interesting. You know, because he was, Joe was actually in the very barracks, those very barracks that they had built the tunnel. And Gerald, you tell a very interesting story when they're forced to abandon the camp.
Right. Yeah, Joe was in barracks number 104, which is the, it was underneath that stove that Tunnel Harry, I think it was called Tunnel Harry, was built.
Yeah, Harry.
As escaped from. And what was interesting is when Joe came into the camp, the airmen in there had things extremely well organized, and their security was extremely tight. Joe was given the job basically a watchman to give the alert when German guards were approaching, because amazingly they were rebuilding that tunnel in exactly the same spot. And when Joe left, he noticed that Barracks 104 was on fire. And I can't remember exactly where I found this out, but they had lit it on fire in order to hide the evidence that the tunnel was, that they were rebuilding the tunnel. Joe had no idea at the time that they were doing that. He knew they were doing something to try and escape, but they did not share that the security was really tight. He just knew that he had to give a certain hand signal when he saw a German guard approach.
Yeah, it's really odd, you know, how everything comes around. Like they say, the world is a circle. It always comes back around to one spot. And, you know, I'm looking in the chat room how other people are talking about their parents. Vorp says his father was a submarine crewman in the Pacific. You know, you never really think about, you know, talking about these things. And you were mentioning, Colin, that some of these guys are doing it because as they get up older in life, you know, they feel they've got to get that story told. And about a year before my father passed, he only passed away this last October, I had been down to visit my parents, and he started putting together a scrapbook of his memories because he was one of the occupying troops right after the war. He didn't turn 18 until just a few days before VE Day, and his mom wouldn't let him enlist. But he did go, and he brought back all those memories, but he never spoke about them, you know. we're losing a precious amount of our national treasure when we lose these men. But thanks to you and to Gerald and to Adam, you know, preserving that history.
Well, Gerald's entered the pantheon of historians who took a very obscure piece. He took a very obscure piece of history and basically turned it into a main story. And that's what a good historian does. Anybody can write a book about what happened, but when you reach out and touch part of that living history and bring that out into the public forum, then you chronicle something for all time. And I think we as historians need to be more than just chroniclers of the tale. We need to be purveyors and the prognosticators of the future. We have to warn people that, you know, Santayana was right. You can't forget it or you'll repeat it.
That's true. And I'm telling everyone that they should go over and watch the movie. And I'm putting the link up again in the chat room, which is www.lostairmen.com. Now,
Well, I saw that.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, sorry, I saw that documentary on the History Channel about 4 years ago, and I'm thinking, you know what, that sounds real damn familiar. I better go back and check my interviews.
That was before we made that before we got that precious nugget of information from you, Colin, and Bad Hana Spotlock. I, you know, there's something I really want to go back and edit some things and include Spotlock and some of this information that, you know, that you provided after we did that. So maybe we'll have to work on it.
Well, not just Trotloff. Remember, Trotloff called Galland immediately from that desk and he in Berlin, and he called him and told him, and Galland said, get the hell out of there, get back here quick, and let's solve the problem. And Galland is the one who went to Erhard Milch, because Milch was the only guy he knew he could probably trust with the information to get it done. And Milch got it done for them. And that needs to be told. Because Erhard Milch was second in command of Luftwaffe. He was also Jewish.
Right. So he was really taking the risk. And wasn't it true that Milch said, I'm not going to write a letter, I'm not going to put anything down in writing, but I'll make a phone call?
Absolutely. He made the phone calls, and who he called, we do not know. How it evolved, we do not know, but we do know that the men were released within, I guess it was like 10 days or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't long after the visit. But you also mentioned on the phone to me one time about Himmler's reaction to that. I know I didn't see that in Steinhoff's interview, but do you have any more information on that?
Say that again. Which part?
You mentioned that Heinrich Himmler, when he found out these men had been released, was very angry.
Yeah, that came from Karl Wolff, SS General Karl Wolff, who was Heinrich Himmler's right-hand man. Heydrich was the left, and Karl Wolff told me that.
What you told me on the phone is that Himmler was so mad he threw a wine glass against the wall.
Yeah, that was Wolff's. Himmler found out about it. He got a phone call from, I believe it was Hans Frank, wanting to know if he had authorized this transition. And Himmler apparently said, what transition? What are you talking about? And then he hurled his glass against the wall, yeah.
Well, you know, what strikes me about that is it's 168 airmen, after all. I mean, there's thousands, tens of thousands of them that are in POW camp. The level of attention or the level of awareness that was going on at these levels in Berlin at that time is just astonishing to me.
Well, the biggest reason, remember, in 1942, following the January Wannsee Conference, when they had the conference in Berlin, and I interviewed the last surviving member of that conference where they actually planned the Holocaust and had built Auschwitz, and secrecy. They knew that if these men went to camps, if these men went to any other place and began talking about what they saw, the word was going to get out. And they did not know that Count Bernadotte and the Red Cross of the Swedes and the Swiss had already leaked the information out to the Americans and the British.
And this is really fascinating stuff. Now, Hans Traugott, when he went and was doing his inspection of all the places that were supplying the Luftwaffe with their munitions and everything else, he actually came across Buchenwald by accident, didn't he?
Yeah, he was going to a couple of factories. One was making parachute harnesses, I think, and the other was a munitions factory. And they were doing low-flash munitions for the night fighter force. And his job as inspector of day fighters, Galland told him, go to all these places, see what's damaged. I have to have a report. the Air Ministry needs a report of how much damage control we need to implement because of what's lost, what can be replaced, you know, just basic logistical stuff. And he was driving around checking to see which camp, which manufacturing centers were impeded, which were unscathed, which were destroyed. And that's how he came across the camp. It was a sheer accident he came across it. His driver made a wrong turn is what happened.
That's
when they saw the gate.
That's so interesting to me because obviously we were speculating when we did the film and we talked to the survivors a lot who we interviewed for the movie about how they did it. And in the film, and obviously it's wrong according to your account of it, is that there was a lot of speculation about a Dutch guy who was in a prisoner but who had been granted special treatment because he was an athlete and was training some of these, that he had gotten access to the outside when he took word of these guys in there to a post office, and from there outside the camp, and from there it went to the BBC, who would broadcast in German for the Germans to pick up that there were these airmen in Buchenwald, and that's how we understood it came to the attention of the officers in Berlin that there were men there, but obviously there's. No,
the broadcast was made. I just don't know if the name of the camp was given, but they gave a location. Mm-hmm. But Troutloff was totally unaware of it. He did not know anything about that, I don't believe.
Well, that's a first-hand account. That's certainly
the great irony, because if Troutloff's driver had not made a wrong left turn over the railroad track and seen the gate, he would not have. Those men would have died.
Yeah, and the other part of it is, these prisoners, they were in prison clothes. They didn't obviously have their uniforms or anything like that, which whatever clothes they had. And there was a German speaking American flyer who called out to him. He saw him in the camp and called out to him. And then the SS guards were trying to rush him away so he wouldn't find these Allied airmen in there. But he called out to him and Karloff pushed him aside and said, "No, I'm going to talk to these guys." So, it's high drama in my mind.
Well, Hannes is pretty. I mean, Hannes is one of these guys. As all German officers were, they were rank conscious. But when an SS captain walks up and tells a German Air Force colonel he can't do something, the colonel's not going to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Something about rank.
and then he warned the commandant, as I recall, that they would be back, and these guys better be in good shape when he came back, right?
Yeah, he told him. He told him on the phone, and Gallen was on the phone. Gallen corroborated that. He said, "Yeah, I heard him on the phone tell the guy." He said, "Listen, Hauptsturmfuhrer, if anything happens to these men before I get back here, I'm going to come see you personally." I mean, he made it real, real clear that this guy's life was going to change for the worse if he came back and found anything had happened to these guys.
Yeah.
Now, we've got a lively conversation going up in the chat room. One of our listeners, who also is another contributor here on Blog Talk Radio, writes that my dad was with Mush Morton, and Mush Morton, it appears, was a premier submarine commander, U.S. submarine commander, and his dad was on board the USS Tang off the coast of Japan when she was sunk by enemy aircraft. It appears almost the entire crew was able to get off, not all, but most of them, and they survived. Now, that's an interesting story to come.
Yeah, the submarine war in the Pacific is another whole dynamic, and I've interviewed some of those guys. In fact, I interviewed Hashimoto, who sank the USS Indianapolis. Look that story up sometime.
Wow. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff that you've got. Are you going to be writing about any of this in the Pacific?
Yeah, if reincarnation is real, then I'll come back and write more books, but I just don't know if I'm going to have enough. I'm 52 years old. I need another 50 years just to go through the documents,
You're young. But, Gerald, here's an idea for you for a book, too, about this one incident.
Well, I was going to say, maybe, Colin, you can delegate some of those to me. I'm looking for a good story.
Hey. Why not? I could be a facilitator here, you and Colin.
Plus, I'm older than you, so you have to move fast.
Well, then again, it all comes down to resources. If you've got the money to fly to the archives, that's great. When I was in grad school, the school paid for it, but I had to donate the research, so.
Man. It's a lot of interesting stuff, and I am absolutely fascinated. Kel, I know you have one last question before we get ready to end this. Got to lose Kel?
I'm going to address this to Gerald first and then Colin. I would love it if you would also answer. When you speak with the veterans and you write these books, does it take a lot out of you emotionally? Because some of the stories you must hear must be heartbreaking.
Wow, that's a good point. You know, I really can't say that. You know, one of the things that I tried to do in going back to writing the story from the German machine gunner's point of view, because these guys have a lot of facts. They don't necessarily have a lot of the emotional content, the experience content. So I would try to put myself in their shoes, and then I would, write about it, but then obviously check it with them to say, hey, is this how you felt? Is this what was going through your mind at that time? And if it wasn't, I would, obviously make it because I wanted to be, truly from their perspective. But I don't, certainly there were parts of it in learning more about Buchenwald and what happened there and how some of these guys were treated, as well as, so many of the stories of the fighter pilots and it's just sad and tragic and heartbreaking. But I found the whole process tremendously stimulating because, probably because of Joe. And Joe was only a symbol of so many of these great heroes of this greatest generation. He was a guy who lived in this community for so many years. People didn't know. He was the quiet little furnace repair guy. And for people who had been taking him in their homes and had no idea, and suddenly realizing they had this, this man with great strength and courage, what he went through to have that recognition and to know that we're doing something good here. this is something of real value. So no, I found that quite innovating, if that makes sense.
What about you, Colin?
Yeah, I've interviewed people who, I've interviewed people who made me rage and want to just leap across the table and choke them. But then I've interviewed people that they grab your hand, are crying, and they're telling you, wish I could have done more, or wish I could have done something different. And you feel the pain these people have, especially some of the civilians I've interviewed who were involved in Europe, or even some of the soldiers who witnessed atrocities. I interviewed an SS corporal who was at Babi Yar in the Ukraine during the mass shootings in 1941. And he ditched his uniform and deserted and hid out in Romania. He headed west and hid out in Romania with a distant relative. So you get wrapped up in their stories, and if you read the book Ace of Speak 2, you read Hartman's account of what the Russian soldiers, actually Ukrainian soldiers, were doing to the women and the babies. The women and the children, what they were doing, even raping the corpses after they had killed them. And he's looking at you going, will people ever believe this? Will they believe it? And I said, Eric, I think they will, because you're not the only person who told me this. And they're looking at you like they hope you believe them because they've never said it. They don't talk about this stuff.
No, that's what I was saying, with my mother-in-law, that she was one of those that was fleeing from what was going on in Latvia, where we had to hang the women and the little girls up on the door of the barn. And as the Soviet troops came through, they would do what they were doing. And she fled for her life with her infant child hiding in the field. And it's amazing that they were able to survive. But we're down to our last 5 minutes. And Colin, this has been fantastic. Gerald, thank you so very much. Gerald, your book is up on Amazon.com. There is a link up in the chat room on there. And I'll make sure that when we come over, that'll be put up on top of the show page here so people can click on it. But there's also a link to the movie, which is LostAirman.com. I'm telling people to go check out the movie. There's two versions. There is one that is an expanded version that has additional film footage on it. So I would go for the one with that's expanded. Colin, your books are up on HeatonLewisBooks.com.
It's LewisHeatonBooks.com.
I'm sorry. That's right. You put your wife's name first.
Yes.
Smart man. Smart man.
I find life is more enjoyable that way.
Well, give Anne-Marie my regards, okay?
Well, there's over the new house getting ready for stuff, so.
Oh, congratulations on the moving. I got a message that you are now up in North Carolina, so enjoy. But you can't be a stranger down here either.
Oh, no. We'll be doing stuff, you know.
Okay. Well, I'll be talking with you. So I want to thank you, Gerald and Colin, for joining us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Great opportunity and really appreciate it.
Oh, fantastic. And thank you for such a wonderful read. That's Gerald Barron. You can find his books up on Amazon. There's a link up there, or just go to Amazon and check out Fighter Pilot in Buchenwald, the Joe Moses story. And also then you can go to lewisheatonbooks.com to see all of Colin's fantastic books. And he's got a slew of them up there and some great pictures of our veterans and him with them and doing the interviews. We got some great guests coming up on Friday, Kel. We've got Michael Conley, and he's got the update on what is going on with impeachment proceedings. And that followed by next Tuesday, Trevor Loudon will be joining us because he is here stateside, so we won't have the technical difficulties we had last time we had tried to have him on. So he's on a tour for a movie he's promoting. And then Debbie Wasserman Schultz has a challenger in the name of Joe Kaufman. He'll be joining us also. And for Joe Kaufman, there are two guys that have this rap song up on YouTube called Thomas and Eric Miller. They'll be joining us. I mean, fantastic. I laughed when I saw it. And I'm not someone who likes hip-hop or rap. So we've got great guests lined up. And I want to thank everyone for joining us. We will be back here again on a Friday, same bat time, same bat station. And also, please remember to give our co-host Dan Butcher your prayers because he is in the hospital. And I will be talking to his wife in just a little while after we close the show. So please say prayers for him. She said he is very ill. So until then, we say good night and God bless to you all. Please be safe out there.
Good night, Annie. Good night, Gerald and Colin.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble.
You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.web.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American. American.